From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, where might Milwaukee's hypothetical new basketball arena hypothetically be built?
Ultimately, I think the public and private sectors, as they look at this project, it certainly will help to visualize a location.
Later, how climate change is a national security issue.
Water shortage, food shortage, living space. All of these are being negatively impacted by climate change. In other words, global warming is exacerbating all of these problems.
The remarkable story of how a knock on the head turned Jason Padgett into a math genius. And on Memorial Day, what supporting the troops really means. Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Welcome to the show, and I hope you're enjoying the Memorial Day weekend. The Milwaukee Bucks are under new ownership, but are still facing an old problem, an old arena, that is. They've been told by the NBA that a plan is needed to renovate or replace the BMO Harris Bradley Center for the team to remain viable in Milwaukee. A sizable task force has been meeting to discuss how a new arena could be paid for and whether to wrap that idea up with the idea of added support for the city's other cultural assets. But another debate is brewing over where a new arena might be built. It's a debate Milwaukee Business Journal senior reporter Rich Kirchen has written about, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
So good to be here.
Is discussing the site for an arena putting the cart before the horse, or is determining the ideal site part and parcel of the strategy to get the proposal to the next step?
Well, it is putting the cart before the horse, but why not? Because ultimately, I think the public and private sectors, as they look at this project, it certainly will help to visualize a location. So it's to say, well, we're going to have a new arena. Whether you agree or disagree, you want to picture where it might be and what kind of impact it might have, what kind of reverberation throughout the downtown area.
So a lot of the discussion has been about the Park East area, but you write that there are some now who would really like this to anchor a revival of the Westtown district, which is perhaps best known for being where the Bradley Center is.
Well, the Bradley Center is, it would probably be like the northwest corner of Westtown. The main section of Westtown certainly is Wisconsin Avenue. And the idea, actually, it's not a new idea. And it certainly has been mentioned, the possibility of, if there is going to be an arena, why not put it at the site of what is now known as the U.S. Cellular Arena? It's 60-plus years old, and the Milwaukee Theater, which is getting to be about 100 years old, that's a prime alternative, and or at least one that's out there. And Rocky Marcoux, the city development commissioner, actually floated a very ambitious and sort of wide-ranging proposal last September when he was over at Marquette talking with Mike Goucher. And it was just a concept, and Mr. Marcoux has sort of backed off on it. Because now the things have changed. At that time, we didn't know the Bucks were being sold, and they have. We didn't know that Herb Cole was going to pledge $100 million and that the new owners would pledge $100 million to a new arena. Nevertheless, there are a lot of people out there who I talked with, urban planners, Bob Greenstreet from UWM, some other leading architects in town who think that location makes more sense than either immediately north of the Bradley Center or a block or two north of the Bradley Center on the Park East corridor, just because of the impact it could have in Westtown.
So the question is, what happens to the Bradley Center sites and how does it relate to whether an arena goes into the Park East area or Westtown? Or is that still really up in the air?
It is up in the air. Yeah, and that's something that—
I mean, I guess it's all up in the air.
Rocky Marcoux didn't really address that when he floated his grand scheme. The Wisconsin Center District, which owns the U.S. Cellular Arena, the Convention Center, and the Milwaukee Theater, came out with a plan a couple weeks ago that showed their buildings staying in place and sort of having a pedestrian walkway between the theater and the arena, tear down the Bradley Center, turn that into this wonderful public-private plaza. So they're saying tear it down and build a new arena on the block immediately to the north of the BMO Harris Bradley Center. Certainly the BMO Harris Bradley Center would need to be used by the Bucks and the other tenants like Marquette and the Admirals while a new arena is being built. So it might be one of those things where first things first, figure out where a new arena would be built and then figure out the Bradley Center later. Could be a separate decision. It could be part of a package deal.
Well, and the folks from the Wisconsin Center District are pretty adamant about the idea of keeping the U.S. Cellular Arena or whatever it'll be called when the naming deal ends and the Milwaukee Theater. What are their arguments for the long-term maintenance of those two facilities?
Well, Frank Gimbel, who's the chairman of the Wisconsin Center District, is the one who's been outspoken on this. First of all, yes, they still owe $27 million from a $41 million project that was completed over a decade ago. They converted the Milwaukee Auditorium to the Milwaukee Theater. So you'd have to pay that off somehow. Beyond that, he argues that both of those buildings, the old Milwaukee Arena and the Milwaukee Theater, serve an essential purpose in this community that a larger NBA-size arena does not, and that is for smaller events. Right now, the U.S. Cellular Arena is the home of UWM men's basketball and the Milwaukee Wave. They hold other events there like the Shrine Circus and Dancing on Ice or whatever it's called, you know, smaller type events. Of course, the roller derby team does their events there. So,
and these are things that would be hard pressed to fit in the schedule for a large NBA style.
Right,
arena.
And then the Milwaukee Theater is sort of a missing link. Some people would say a weak link in the theater hierarchy in Milwaukee. Riverside Theater and Eline Hall both are in the low 2,000 capacity. Milwaukee Theater is about a 4,000. So it's some shows fit there that wouldn't fit anywhere else.
And so presumably this issue of location is going to be taken up by the task force that's looking into the full arena discussion altogether?
That is a good question, Mitch. I don't know that they will get that granular, you know, that they'll get that specific granular. they're talking big concepts. They're talking about community-wide needs, certainly the possibility of a new arena, but also funding for the Marcus Center for the Arts, the zoo, the public museum, and so on. I think that group is going to be more at a global kind of level, like, yes, we think it'd be a good idea to commit some public resources to a new arena, but I don't think that task force is the one that's going to say where it would be. It's going to come down more to practical decision. The new Bucks owners, Mark Lazary and Wes Edens, are going to be driving this train to the extent that they can, to the extent that sort of this, I'm going to mix my metaphors now, the wild bucking bronco that is Milwaukee politics and community discussion. But they want a plan within a year for a new arena. So they're going to have a major input. The Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce has its own, I call it a super committee, some very big name business types who are going to weigh in on this. Ultimately, the city and county of Milwaukee may play a role. The state could play a role. So those are the folks that are probably going to get looking at the brass tacks of where would be the best site. Certainly those, I think both the business and public players in this want to do something that will have the most bang for the buck, or for the bucks, as we say. Much greater good could happen if you had private development around it. You know, the story I did talks about the obvious, like retail, restaurants, hotels. But, you know, some of the architects I talked to said, what about a movie theater? Bowling alley, you know.
It is Milwaukee.
and certainly maybe some kind of public square that would have events in it, maybe an amphitheater. So there are all kinds of possible spinoffs that could really turn things around.
Do the new Bucks owners know what they've gotten themselves into?
Well, I talked with Wes Edens this week, and he only said that he knew that they had a lot of work to do and that it was going to be a big challenge. But beyond that, no.
To be continued. Rich Kirchen, thanks so much.
Thanks, Mitch.
Rich Kirchen is a senior reporter at the Milwaukee Business Journal. He continues to cover the debate over a proposed new arena to house the NBA's Milwaukee Bucks. A quick break now, and then what three recent developments contribute to our understanding of climate change? This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The Milwaukee area's beautiful spring weather comes after a remarkably cold and snowy winter in Wisconsin, but the region's ideal conditions are in the minority globally. A recent report shows that this April was the world's warmest on record. George Stone is our occasional contributor on climate change issues. He's instructor of natural sciences at Milwaukee Area Technical College, and he's with us to talk about three other stories of significance relating to a warming climate. Nice to see you.
Thanks for inviting me, Mitch. It's always a pleasure.
So there are three significant reports related to climate change that have come out in recent days and weeks, and I want to get into each of them in some detail. First, the federal government issued something called the National Climate Assessment not long ago. Before we get to the findings themselves, what can you tell us about the team that generated the work? These were not all just, as they say, government scientists.
Oh, no. I think a major component was academic scientists, research scientists and professors, and some who work for private research institutions, but by no means all government. That's right.
And maybe this is an obvious point, but it seems as though the significance of the report is not that it is not a forecast, but reflection of the current state of affairs.
That's right. That's the main point of emphasis for the National Climate Assessment. And that is, unlike previous assessments, the emphasis is that climate change is already here, and we are already feeling and paying for the many negative, mostly negative impacts attendant upon that change.
You say mostly negative impacts, and the climate assessment does make the point that there have been a couple of, at least in the short run, positives, the longer growing season and the longer shipping season in on the Great Lakes, for example. But overall, this was a pretty bleak picture that the assessment paints.
That's right. And it really just confirmed forecasts that have been being generated for the last couple of decades by these reports, both the international reports and the National Climate Assessment. And I might add the assessments done by our own military, the Pentagon. And there was a report just issued last week by a group called CNA Corporation for the military, which documents the fact that climate change is a serious national security threat.
Well, and how is that? Let me ask maybe a dumb question. Connect the dots for us. Climate change to national security.
Well, you know, if you look at the major global problems, water shortage, food shortage, living space, all of these are being negatively impacted by climate change. In other words, global warming is exacerbating all of these problems. And the analysis shows that this, of course, leads to unhappy people if you don't have clean water to drink, if you don't have enough food. And that leads to political instability. That leads to increased violence and conflict. And all of the kinds of political instabilities in regions and around the world that threaten and weaken national security.
And of course, the National Climate Assessment came out in recent weeks, so it came out before some of the major things that have happened in this country happened, such as another round of tornadoes and more recently the significant wildfire issue in the Southwest.
The wildfire issue is one that is really getting serious. The number of acres burned has doubled in the last decade. The frequency and the intensity of the wildfires has dramatically increased, especially in the West and Southwest, California and Arizona being the leading states, but also throughout the Western United States. And these are directly relatable to prolonged droughts, record-breaking high temperatures, heat waves. Also, not altogether out of the picture is the increase in trees killed by insects. The pine beetles and spruce beetles, which have thrived under the recently relatively warm winter regime that we've seen in the western United States. And, of course, when the trees are dead, they dry out, and they're much more susceptible to fires. So it's a whole package of impacts resulting from climate change that have triggered this dramatic increase. And it's a very serious matter. I mean, people are killed. Homes are destroyed. Acreage is burned up. This is perhaps... It depends where you live, but this is perhaps one of the most serious impacts that we're already feeling.
Well, from a place with a lot of trees to a place with no trees, in recent days we've seen a report on an apparent major destabilization in the ice in Antarctica. What can you tell us about that situation?
Well, there are a number of research papers that have been published recently on these two areas. Antarctica may be considered as two main ice shelves. The biggest one by far and the thickest is the East Antarctic Ice Shelf, and a paper on that, although we've thought of that as relatively stable, satellite data have shown that the mass has decreased. The satellites measure the gravity, which is a function of the mass of the ice. And this recent study showed that a glacier in the Wilkes Basin, which acts as a kind of plug for that part of the East Antarctic Ice Shelf, is melting rapidly. And if that plug is removed, that will allow the inland glaciers to flow out through that basin to the sea at a much accelerated pace. So that's been a research that indicates maybe the eastern Antarctic ice cap is not so stable as we formerly thought. The West Antarctic ice shelf, especially along the Antarctic Peninsula, is one of the most rapidly warming areas on the planet. And recent papers show that there again, the kind of ice damming glaciers along the coast and the ice shelves are melting and allowing the ice to flow out from the interior much more rapidly. And this melting is being accelerated by warmer water that's coming up from deeper levels in the Antarctic Ocean. And this upwelling has been driven by increased winds in the circumpolar circulation around the Great Southern Ocean, around Antarctica. So the West Antarctic ice shelf now is beginning to melt and flow out. Eric Rigneau, in particular Rigneau at University of California, Irvine, has pointed out that this is now unstoppable. The West Antarctic ice shelf is going to melt and collapse. The timing seems as though it's going to be relatively slow in the coming decades through this century, but then with the danger of greatly accelerating in the future.
This is a term called early stage collapse.
Yes. But I must point out, these forecasts and these predictions have always been revised upward. If you look back at the history of predictions for sea level rise and for the melting of Antarctica or Greenland, as more research and more data accumulate, the predictions, the projections have always been revised upward to faster and sooner. And so we can't be confident that this is in the distant future either.
One of the interesting aspects to the story, especially the Antarctic story, is that there were scientists who were predicting this was likely to happen as far back as the late 1970s, which is well before climate change was on the radar for practically everyone.
Well, that's right, because it's basically an unstable system. If the temperature projections were there, but we had kind of a temperature plateau in the middle part of the 20th century, rapid warming globally in the first half of the 20th century, then a kind of plateau in the 50s and 60s, probably due primarily to a large accumulation of aerosols in the atmosphere, which were screening out some of the sunlight. And then starting again in the last three decades of the 20th century, it accelerated again. So back in the 70s, these predictions were made in 1976. It looked as though the global temperatures were kind of plateauing. But I think these scientists recognize that was just a temporary lull, as we've seen a little bit in the last decade, a temporary lull in the overall global warming trend.
You mentioned Greenland, and I want to touch on that briefly. There are more recent reports that the ice in Greenland is also less stable than we had believed.
That's right. There are a couple of factors there. First of all, on in July of 2012, just less than 2 years ago, I think it was actually on July 12th when it peaked, the entire surface of the Greenland ice sheet melted, entirely covered by water. And we thought this was largely due to temperature change, to increasing temperatures, which it was in part. But the research has shown that it's – and a major component of that is the accumulation of soot on the surface of the snow and ice, soot from wildfires in throughout Siberia, the taiga, the great temperate zone forest that covers not only Canada but most of Siberia, increased wildfires, more soot in the atmosphere, and also all the way from California in the western United States. And that soot settles out very slowly and produces a dark coating on the snow and ice, which greatly increases the amount of radiation that's absorbed from the sun and increases the melting. So this accumulation of soot is a kind of a feedback because it comes from climate change-induced wildfires, but it also accelerates the melting of snow and ice as far away as Greenland.
George Stone, thank you so much.
My pleasure as usual, Mitch. Thank you.
George Stone is an instructor of natural sciences at Milwaukee Area Technical College and a Lake Effect contributor on climate change. Jason Padgett's life changed after a mugging and assault, but probably not the way you might imagine. His unique story when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. In September of 2002, Jason Padgett was 31 and managing his family's futon shop in Tacoma, Washington. His life was a whirlwind of working out, drinking, girls, and karaoke bars. And it was leaving a karaoke bar that his life changed forever. Padgett was mugged, and the resulting injuries caused a profound change in his brain chemistry. Overnight, he acquired an intrinsic understanding of advanced math, a subject that he had never studied and for which he had no seeming prior aptitude. Additionally, he developed synesthesia, in which two or more senses overlap. In Padgett's case, he sees light broken into its mathematical components. Padgett details his story in a memoir called Struck by Genius, How a Brain Injury Made Me a Mathematical Marvel. On a recent visit to Milwaukee, Padgett spoke with Bonnie North and described how he viewed the lights in the Lake Effect studio.
Light, when it comes at me, it looks like that bursting point. If you look at a drawing of pi and you see those little lines bursting outwards, that's always what it looks like. And when I move, of course, it looks like little picture frames of it. But instead of like the pie as I draw it, technically is the geometry of the rainbow. So all I'm seeing is the burst here, whereas the light beams that are coming out and they're hitting and bouncing off at the angle they hit at. So, you know, the geometry winds up being different, but they're always identical to the center burst of the drawing of pie.
Are there colors involved, or is it just the light color that you see?
You know, just the color that I see. It's like I don't see like the letter T is blue, that type of thing like some people do. Everything is like a grid structure.
The reason I asked you about this is because when you were 31, your life changed utterly.
Yes.
Utterly. A lot of people say they have life-changing experiences, but yours truly shifted down to your brain chemistry.
Yes.
So what happened?
Well, I went to a little karaoke bar. I had a friend there, and she was on a first date with this guy, and they were singing karaoke, and they had too much to drink, and they wanted me to come pick him up. And so I went there, sang a song, Bon Jovi's Blaze of Glory, and then had a Coke, you know, paid for it, and then left. There was all these two guys that were also singing. They were clean cut. They looked like normal people. They didn't look like, you know, too rough. And as we left, they followed us out and were behind us, and then I was attacked by them. As we left.
And you sustained some traumatic brain injury.
Yes.
Because of that.
Yeah. I didn't even see it coming. I just saw literally like somebody took a picture, a bright white flash of light, and felt this deep thud in the back of my head. And the next thing I knew, I was on my knees trying to figure out, why am I on my knees? Why is the world spinning? Why am I getting hit from all these different directions? It was so just completely disorientating trying to figure out what's going on after, even though it was just, I was only unconscious from the time that I was standing to hitting my knees, it still takes you a second to even get any type of bearings back. Yes, I sustained a head injury or brain injury from this and went to the hospital afterwards. And they just diagnosed me with a severe concussion and a bleeding kidney and then sent me home with some pain medicine.
When did it first become apparent to you that it wasn't just a concussion?
I thought it was the pain medicine at first. I was like, this pain medicine is some wild stuff. And then the next day it was obvious. It was like, okay, that stuff is not in me. This is something that has changed radically. And it was so pretty. And the symmetry involved, it's just – it was beautiful. It was stunning. I mean, I remember watching water going down the drain and then just flushing the toilet over and over and watching it.
Because you were seeing patterns?
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Instead of things looking smooth like they used to before, like imagine watching, you know, moving your hand in front of your face. It looks like it's moving smoothly. But our brain is actually taking pictures just like a TV is. When you're watching a TV, say, for instance, you're seeing 40 or 50 frames per second and your brain, you know, shows that as motion. And there's a smooth, continuous motion. It's like those old flip books. If you make a picture and then you flip through it, you can see the image changing, but it's jittery. That's how everything looks now, because there's a part of our brain that all it does is it smooths out the pictures that we take. And that's gone now. Everything, instead of having this smoothness, is all jittery. Best way to think of it is like individual discrete pictures with little filaments connecting the frames. And clouds or water, instead of looking like these smooth spirals, look like these little tangent lines that are changing. So there's this order to it, and it's a form, a recursive form of the Pythagorean theorem. It's like a squared plus b squared equals c. Then you re-input c as a, and if how you b, you could say b equals one, or you could change it, and that'll make it spirals
and it
faster
turns,
or you know, longer.
So basically, it sounds like what you lost was your brain's ability to smoothen those in between spaces.
Definitely, yes.
Okay,
and it makes everything look like pixelated. So what I started doing is mentally overlaying a grid, like a piece of graph paper, on everything that I'm looking at. And I found that as long as I made the grid sufficiently fine or tiny, that I could make the motion of everything that I'm looking at line up with a vertex point on the grid. And as it turns out, that's what calculus is dividing things up into these smaller and smaller grids or subintervals. And the smaller you divide it, and the more accurate your measurement gets. So it's like being forced to see in calculus.
Which is so fascinating, because you had no math background.
Right.
Before this. That
right.
was another big change that happened with this. But let's back up just a second, because you didn't immediately in those first days after you had your injury jump to this. It took you a long time
yes.
to get back into the world again.
Yeah. For a little more than 3 years, I just holed up in my house. I had blankets over the windows. I mean, not a beam of light got in. I didn't leave the house unless I like had to buy groceries, and only when I was out of everything. And then when I would go during the middle of the night, and then I would just load my car so that I could stay in the house as long as possible. Because when I was attacked, all these people watched. Nobody did anything. Nobody helped. And I had post-traumatic stress, which I didn't realize at the time, but I became extremely agoraphobic. And OCD came with this too. I'm not sure why, but there's so much information coming in now, and I notice so much more that I'm always noticing what's been touched and what could possibly, you know, have contaminated that. Like somebody's walking towards me and I see, you know, the person rub their nose and then do something else, touch a doorknob, and then they walk up to me and want to shake their hand. And all I can think about is the germs that are there, and after I shake their hand, how I need to hand sanitize my hand. In fact, it was so bad, I was literally Lysoling my money and then putting it in the microwave for 30 seconds just to make sure I killed all the germs on the money. And what even made it worse is that it worked. I stopped getting sick. You know, I've had like 3 colds since this happened. And that
reinforces
it.
So it kind of reinforced it. Yeah.
So eventually, I went to a psychologist to help get better at it, you know, to help control it.
But it took you about 10 years, didn't it?
Yes, to really get to the point of where I was in, back into life.
But at the same time, you're still seeing things mm-hmm. with the grid. You're still seeing things pixelated. You're
yes.
still experiencing the world in a profoundly different way.
Completely different.
And so why did it become important to express that to other people?
Well, I was one of those kids that all I did was goof off, party, chase girls, drink. And even – I shouldn't say kid. Up even into adulthood, I was doing that. And I also said, math, this is stupid. After pre-algebra, I was like, you're not going to use this. This is ridiculous. I mean, I was one of those kids that really hated math. And suddenly I could see this underlying order to everything, and it was so beautiful. And I was finding that I was able to explain things like pi or relativity with drawings. And since all I had at the time was layman terms to explain it, I would draw it and then explain it in layman terms. And I was finding that everybody understood it. And for me, it was so beautiful. All I wanted to do was grab every single person that walked by and said, "Did you know this? Here, look at this. Did you know this?" Because it was like the whole universe opened up. It's like having two different lives, you know, where all I could do was talk about it, literally. It's like – but at the same time, I felt agoraphobic, you know, wanting to be alone. But at the same time, I wanted to tell everybody, look how beautiful this is. You can learn it. You think you don't like math, but you're just not seeing it the right way.
You had a wonderful phrase. I think it was one of your math teachers when you went back to community college said, you don't have the vocabulary yet
right.
to talk about this. Have you learned that?
Yeah, I've gone back to school and like I've taken, you know, all the standard math classes through the calculus series and up into linear algebra, which is probably like junior level. But it was amazing for me because like the very first time I went to algebra, I didn't know that an equation was graphed. So they graphed this equation and I was like, wait a second. You mean all equations are talking about geometry? And my teacher was like, yes. You know, everything we're doing is discussing or describing the geometry of the universe. And I'm like, well, I'm just drawing it in its natural form, and you're doing equations, but we're talking about the same thing, just in two different languages. Only the language of geometry is the natural language of math, whereas equations we have made up to describe the geometry. But the equations are good because they can prove things. They're done in a way that you can prove it, whereas if I draw a picture of pi, it doesn't prove it. But after I went back to school, of course, then I learned how to write the equation to prove that what I drew really was pi.
Was the thing.
Right.
And pi runs through your book as probably the thing that gives your life meaning, I would say.
Yeah. It applies to everything. Pi actually defines angles, and everything in the universe is geometry, and geometry is just one angle relative to another one. And so every straight line is 180 degrees because it's two right triangles. Every triangle, if you add up the inner angles, is 180 degrees also. And to convert degrees into measurements made by pi, you multiply by pi over 180. So anything that's 180 degrees times pi over 180 is 180 times pi divided by 180. 180 divided by 180 is 1. 1 times pi is pi. So every straight line and every triangle is pi in a different form.
We're talking about this sort of savant syndrome that came on as a result of this attack. You're also talking about synesthesia too, and
right.
you became a synesthete, right? That was not something you were born with.
No.
And so what form of synesthesia do you have?
It's just this grid structure, seeing numbers as grid. Like say the number four is just, well, it depends on how you do it, but four could be, you know, four grids in a row or four in a square. Like for instance, if we had four as a square, so we have four squares, little squares, making a square that gives us a total of four squares, making one square. So that's the number four. And then four to the second power, four squared, is taking that four and geometrically squaring it into 16. Four cubed is taking that and three-dimensionally cubing it into 64. It's one and the same thing, or the third root of 64. If you take that cube of 64 and you take it apart into its root, becomes that four, those four cubes.
And that's how you see it.
That's how I see it, yeah.
So when if I say four to you,
right.
that's there.
That's it.
You know, I've known people who've had other kinds of synesthesia, the kinds where you attach colors to letters or numbers and will change depending on what letters and numbers are next to each other and that sort of thing. And I know there are synesthetes who can taste sound hear tastes.
Yeah, they say that smells like blue and you're like, huh.
But that's not something that you...
No.
But it must have been amazing to finally talk to people who had a similar kind of thing, even if it wasn't exactly what you had.
Right.
It didn't maybe manifest in exactly the same way, but it was the same idea that these senses were all intermingling.
Yes. I was watching a show and I saw this guy named Daniel Tammet, and he memorized pi to like 22,500 decimals, and he was talking about the way his numbers looked to him. And I remember being so excited, realizing that, okay, this is something that is real. Because there was a lot of times, you know, in that 3 years where I was by myself where I was like, you know, when you see somebody that's really crazy and they don't know it, am I one of those people right now that I'm drawing all this stuff and saying, this is pi at this value, and I'm the only one that thinks it, you know, and I just don't know that I'm crazy? And so it was very nice to see that this was something that was real. And then, of course, going back to school to be able to prove that that was pi was just absolutely awesome. I recommend, you know, everybody, you know, go to school for sure and at least see if you like it, you know, and try to learn pi and relativity this way if you can before you go to school.
And see what happens.
And see what happens, yeah. And if you like it, great.
Wisconsin also played a key part of your new life, and there was a gentleman in Fond du Lac, right?
Yeah.
What did he do?
Dr. Treffert. He was the real Rain Man, Kim Peek. He studied him, and he also advised on the movie The Rain Man, and he's the leading savant expert. He diagnosed me, and I came to Fond du Lac and got to visit him there, and it was wonderful. He was very nice, showed me around. It helped introduce me to other people in the world that are studying savant syndrome also. And finally being able to be diagnosed, know what was going on, and start connecting to people and getting brain studies done to see what exactly had happened. Because there was, you know, negative things that came with it too. Like me holding up in my house, I had post-traumatic stress and OCD came with it. I get these uncontrolled muscle movements several hundred times a day. It kind of feels like my phone vibrating, and that happens all throughout my body. And I was worried, you know, that I had MS or ALS, and all those other things were ruled out. It turns out there's something called benign muscle fasciculations, where it's just they don't know why, but your muscles just move by themselves, but it's not going to kill you.
It's not a disease,
right,
per se.
But I was really worried that
sure.
I was. Yeah.
Why wouldn't you be? Yeah. You know, it's something you'd never had before.
Right.
Do you ever fear that this you will disappear and you'll revert?
I've heard about a case where a lady had, I think she had dementia, and she was able to draw these amazing paintings, and then slowly as the dementia got worse, it did go away. And I used to worry about it a lot more. Now, it's been so long, I don't think it will, you know, but anything's possible, but I don't think it will. I certainly hope it doesn't, you know, and I certainly hope I don't ever revert back to the way I was, you know, even if like suddenly I couldn't see things like that, hopefully the effects of everything that I've been through will keep my personality more like this, because I feel like I definitely have two different lives, and a large portion of my personality is different in many ways too. So it definitely feels like two lives, but I would not want it to go away, even with the bad that came with it. The good so overwhelms the bad that it's worth it.
Do you feel that you have the vocabulary now, or is there still more to learn?
There's a lot more. I mean, I have the vocabulary in a certain way, but every time I talk to these PhDs, they know so much more than I do in certain ways, and I just – like savant syndrome, some people who love the term is not nice. They would say idiot savant, you know, meaning that you're either normal or less than normal in most things, and you just excel at this one particular area. And so I definitely have a lot to learn about everything. And that's all I want to do is just learn. But I would be satisfied if I could just get the few things that I've drawn out into the curriculum to really help, you know, bring the level of our kids up a little higher, because that's one thing that our country needs to do is to help our kids with math, get them more interested in it, show them how it does apply. In fact, there's nothing that you can't use it for. So all those people that say, oh, that's silly, you can't use that in real life, you do, and you use it all the time, and there's nothing that you can't apply it to. It's just learning how that you can apply it. The one problem is that when you go to taking traditional mathematics, you're pretty much learning rules until you get to calculus. And once you start going through calculus, it all starts to come together. And that's when it gets really powerful. But the problem is most of us don't make it to calculus.
We don't get there.
Right.
Yeah. Sometimes I think we need to start with the theory of it first and then go through the steps, the mechanical steps.
The mechanical part. Yeah. Show them the fun things of it when they're young so they all are interested in it and it's cool. And then when they're going through those steps, at least they know they're heading towards this really neat thing, you know.
Is that outcome. A goal for you to teach?
Absolutely. I would love to do that to as many people as possible so that we can get this more kids into school. I would love if in like 20 years from now, somebody comes up to me and says, you know what, I was a little kid, I heard about this, and I went into math because of it, and that boy or girl turns out to be the next Einstein, and they invent, you know, cold fusion or some clean energy, you know, because of it. That would, to me, would be the most amazing thing. But it doesn't even have to be that. Just if they go in and they do some good for society, you know, because math and science is so important, especially since everything in the world is going computer, that if you don't know math and science, it's going to be much more difficult to work and to find a job, not to mention how fulfilling it is once you really start understanding it.
And I think that's it, is you've got to get to that point of grasping that fulfillment, of understanding that there's passion and joy in it.
Right. It is. It's beautiful. In fact, Einstein used to always say he knew an equation was right when it was beautiful. Just like when I draw a pie, it is beautiful. And if one of those lines is off, suddenly it doesn't look so pretty. And only when it's pretty and perfectly symmetrical is it correct.
Well, Jason Paget, it has been such a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Jason Paget's memoir, co-written with Maureen Seberg, herself a synesthete, is called Struck by Genius, How a Brain Injury Made Me a Mathematical Marvel. Paget spoke with Bonnie North on a recent visit to Wisconsin. You might be surprised that Jason Paget has something in common with the world-famous violin virtuoso Itzhak Perlman, but Perlman, too, is a synesthete, although of a different sort. We spoke with him before a recent Wisconsin concert, and he described how synesthesia affects his work.
Well, it's I don't take it that seriously, you know. I just find it fascinating that, you know, when I hear notes, you know, I see certain colors for the notes, you know, I define them by certain colors, but then I also define those notes by certain tastes or by certain you know, I mean, even when I talk about a particular sound, you know, I like to always talk about that, comparing it to, you know, yogurt, or as opposed to ice cream, you know, something rich like a chocolate fudge. You know, I like to do that. So I don't know what you call that when you see taste in notes as opposed to seeing colors in notes and so on. But, you know, I look, music is all about, an important part of music is the colors that you say, the actual colors of the sound. So, you know, it's all involved. So I don't know whether that helps me or doesn't help me, but it's always nice to think about it, to be imaginative as to what kind of colors you can produce when you perform, when you play.
Well, and I was wondering if it made it easier in any way to internalize the music, that it was more than just black and white notes on a staff, that it also had these bigger meanings for you.
Well, no, it's not black and white notes at all on staff. You know, once you get it in your ear, it's all what you hear. It's all what you hear, and it's all what you feel about what you're hearing, you know. The inevitability of playing a phrase a certain way, you know, and just making it sound the way you feel about it. It's something that you can't, you know, it's like I've got to do it that way. You know, that there's no other way for me to do this kind of a phrase. That's what it's all about, you know. And to do that at that moment, you know, because then the next day, if you play the same thing, you'll do something else.
Violinist Itzhak Perlman describing how synesthesia affects his life and his music. We spoke with him in April. One last break, and then the islands of Milwaukee and some thoughts about supporting the troops on Memorial Day. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Time now for our weekly segment, The Islands of Milwaukee.
Welcome to the Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towie from the Islands of Milwaukee. This week, I'm going to backtrack a little. Some of my favorite questions of the day focus on sound. What does Milwaukee sound like? What does your neighborhood sound like? What is the most beautiful sound in the world? We got a lot of answers to these questions, but only one from a person who, for most of his life, heard no sounds at all. I met Thomas at an interfaith meal site. He was very friendly and open.
And you said you were born deaf, but you received cochlear implants 2 years ago, right?
Yeah, right.
So can you tell me what it was like after you received those cochlear implants?
It was wonderful. But what's interesting is when I wake up in springtime, I can hear the bird whistling with my cochlear implant. Never had that. Bird whistling in the morning. It was open. It was a good experience. Wonderful.
No matter what sound is your favorite, I bet you'll appreciate it even more if you imagine hearing it for the first time. Thanks for listening.
You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands hotline at 414-678-1653 or by visiting islandsofmilwaukee.org. Finally today, it's Memorial Day, the day when we honor the sacrifice of military people in our past and today. For Lake Effect essayist Corinthia Klein, the sacrifice service people make is worth some sacrifices on the home front.
3 plus 2 is not simply another number. 3 plus 2 is twice as many trips to the grocery store, 4 activities on Tuesday afternoon, needing the minivan every morning, staggering the shower schedule, frequent floor inspections, extra laundry, and a bedtime routine that looks like herding sheep. It also means more hugs, extra laughter, and the chance to pay back some karmic debt. We've been watching a friend's kids for a couple of weeks while she's off serving with the National Guard out of state. Some days having just our 3 kids feels like a lot, but it's amazing how much more organized and on top of things we have to be with 5. We're happy to do it, though. We know this is what supporting the troops really looks like. Our friend in the National Guard is a single parent, and we've been able to relate to her in a way I don't know if many others in our community can. My husband is a major in the Army Reserves and has been deployed to Iraq 2 times. The first time he was called up, we had 6 days notice. I was pregnant, and our daughters were ages 4 and 2. Those 15 months were the most difficult of my life, juggling a preschooler, a toddler, and a newborn. Single parenting is not for the weak. Parenting with a spouse in a war zone is stressful beyond measure. I learned a lot in those days about how much I can handle and what you can do when you have no choice. I also learned how to ask for and accept help. I don't know why as parents we have the sense we should somehow do everything on our own, but I couldn't have gotten through that difficult period of my life if it weren't for family, friends, and even strangers who stepped up and helped me get through the most difficult days. During a deployment, you learn quickly who really means it when they say, "If there's anything I can do." Now, when I hesitate about asking for help, I keep in mind how I feel when giving it. I'm glad to step up, and in my own way pay back those who were kind enough to help me when I needed it. I know others usually feel the same, but simply don't know what they can offer. Military families of people serving in the National Guard or Reserves tend to go unnoticed by people who profess to support the troops, but can often use a helping hand. My advice to people looking to help military families, or really any families experiencing a stressful period, would be to make specific gestures rather than wait for someone to ask. Offer up blocks of time you are available to babysit or give a caregiver a break. Relieve them of an errand or carpool duty or making a meal. Even if they can't take you up on an offer at a particular time, trust me, it will be forever remembered and appreciated. I've had one person after another express astonishment that we are so willing to take on 2 extra kids for a couple of weeks, but it's really not a big deal. They're good kids, and the whole thing is like an extended slumber party with homework instead of games, but I can't imagine not helping out our friend while she's working in service to our country. Besides, if military families can't be counted on to help each other, who can? It's really a matter of offering meaningful support and to understand that helping each other helps us all. 3 plus 2 may not sound like it adds up to much, but as far as I'm concerned, it adds up to everything that matters.
Essayist Corinthia Klein is a violin maker and the mother of 3 in Milwaukee. She and her husband, a veteran, run a neighborhood violin store called Corinthian Violins in Bayview, and she performs on the viola with the Festival City Symphony and on mandola with the Milwaukee Mandolin Orchestra. Her essay also appeared on the website mom.me. That's Lake Effect for Memorial Day, with thanks to all those who have served and sacrificed for their country. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.